Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin. Each episode, I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them that it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a breakup. Games often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, as I search for my perfect console. My guest today is the reclusive designer of one of the greatest video games yet made. He studied game design in Montreal and, after a brief stint working at Ubisoft, left to begin work on a game of his own, a platformer that combined the art style of the Super Nintendo classics of his youth with perspective-shifting innovations of his own. 6 years in the making, Fez launched in 2012 to near universal acclaim, part of the first wave of so-called indie games. After featuring heavily in the film documentary Indie Game the Movie, my guest, who is passionate and outspoken, became the subject of coordinated online attacks which culminated in his retreat from public platforms nearly a decade ago. "I sometimes feel really lucky to be doing what I'm doing," he once told me. "I complain a lot and it's difficult, but I am damn lucky to be doing exactly what I want. Not a lot of people get to say that." Welcome, Phil Fish.
Hi.
Hey, Phil. How have you been the last few years?
I've been okay, considering everything.
You're back in Canada at the moment. Is that where you were for the lockdowns?
Yeah, I spent my COVID years back home in Canada.
And that's where you grew up as well, in Quebec as well?
Yeah, in and out of Montreal.
Is this a rumor or is it true that your real name is Philippe Poisson?
Yes, that is my real name.
Okay.
And there's a thing that happens in Quebec when your name is Philippe Poisson and you introduce yourself to people. More often than not, they go, Phil Fish.
Right.
Just automatically. There's just like an automatic translation that happens where they say it out loud. So that's just kind of always been my name also. You know, the teachers call me that. Like, it's just people think they're funny and clever and they're the first one to come up with it. But it's like near universal.
Does that happen for other members of your family, or is it just fit because you've got Phil as your first name?
My father also had that to a different degree. But yeah, I think the alliteration helps. And it stuck, it cemented itself as a real thing when I started dabbling in the indie scene. And I was working in the industry at big studios that had less than ideal policies about how you can use your spare time in regards to making video games. So at some point when we started getting some attention and doing like interviews and things like that, I started insisting on the separation of like, if we're going to be talking about the indie stuff, use Phil Fish. That way it doesn't come back to my employer as immediately. And I can kind of just have a clear separation between the two. I regret at the time not thinking of doing the Daft Punk thing, wear a mask all the time and then have people not know what I look like. I should have done that.
Yeah, it's like funny for anyone who first knew of you as Phil Fish, it really sounds like Philippe Poisson should be the pseudonym.
No, it's the real. It's the other way around.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it sounds fancier to some people.
It sounds like you're a French spy or something when it's that way around. And then, so just tell me, when did like video games enter your life? Was it something that you had in your household as a young kid?
Oh yeah, pretty much from birth. Like some of my earliest memories, I'm on my dad's knees and he's doing something. I'm on a Commodore 64. There's just always been some form of game played on a video screen my whole life.
And I read that your father translated The Legend of Zelda into French for you. Is that true?
Yeah, we didn't have French version of video games at the time. Maybe they existed. I'm not aware of copies making it to Quebec. But like in France, I'm sure they had the Legend of Zelda in French. But in Quebec, just being part of kind of the North American market, we just got the English box. So for a game that featured not a lot, but some important text, I needed help with that. So yeah, my dad would translate some of that. And I kept like a little journal, a little notebook. And then would translate the things, like, you know.
Oh, I see. So you'd be playing and he'd be sort of reading it out to you, or would he actually write it down for you?
Yeah, you would read it out loud whenever it would happen. And then I would, like, on my map, make a little note or something. When, you know, there's all these hints and all the one that tells you to go somewhere that would have been completely lost on me without the translation. That was one of the first examples of a game having an element like that kept me from, you know, it's not a problem in Mario or Tetris. There's no text.
That is an adorable anecdote. So and your parents were both aspiring artists, but they dropped out of art college, but they were very encouraging to you with your art skills, is that right?
Yeah. Both my parents were art school dropouts that ended up working in kind of creative fields, but not necessarily in creative positions. And so when I went to high school, I went to a special art program. They called it concentration art, where we ended up spending as much time in art class as we did in French and math class combined. Like we were just there half the time, half the days for 5 years, just working with every medium imaginable in this really awesome kind of art lab that had everything. You know, it had a press, it had a dark room to develop pictures. We made our own Obscura cameras. They had a computer lab, which was amazing at the time. You know, we had Photoshop as part of the arts program. And so we got to try everything, painting, sculpting, name it. It was very formative, obviously.
And then you sort of follow in your parents' footsteps in that you then go off to art college yourself, but don't stay there very long. Can you just tell me about that?
Yeah, I ended up doing about 2 weeks of art school in our equivalent of college in Quebec, because having just come out of my special high school program that was very intensive, they were teaching us stuff that I'd learned like 5 years ago that I already knew. It was like if it was your introduction to art, basically. You started year one, you know, art 101 in college. And I was beyond that. So I didn't last very long. I was like, this is just kind of a waste of my time. I'm just rethreading old ground. I ended up dropping out and going to work in the animation industry instead.
Mm-hmm. And that's where your father worked. Is that correct?
Yeah. I was a bit of a nepo baby in the animation industry in Montreal, where my dad got me this job. At first, I was a scanner. I was manually scanning the physical drawings that were being shipped in from Korea by the crate, working the midnight shift in a basement with all the other weirdos. Then eventually, I graduated to 2D painter, where I colored the frames and the drawings frame by frame for a bunch of different kids show, a couple of different production companies, because, film and television, the way employment works there is based on the the productions that are currently in production. And once the production ends, well, they don't have any more work for you. So they fired everybody and they tell you, well, come back in 3 months, we'll have another movie lined up or something. So you ended up just kind of cycling in and out of the 2-3 different production companies in town. And it was all the same people migrating at the same time. It was pretty terrible.
So the format of this podcast is that I'm asking you to pick the 5 video games you want to put on your perfect games machine. Can you tell me about your first game, which I guess you were playing probably while you were still in school in 1998?
Right. Well, in trying to make my list of games, my top criteria was games that I come back to a lot over the years, that I keep just getting back into year in, year out. Either they're short games that can be played and in one sitting, and I do that yearly, or bigger games that I just spread out over years and years and years because I like them so much. And the first one of those is Ridge Racer Type 4 for the PlayStation 1. Bit of a weird pick for me because I'm not a racing game guy at all, not a car guy in the least. I don't know anything about mechanics, car companies, or motorsports in general, like no interest in that stuff at all. But for whatever reason, Ridge Racer Type 4, holy shit, I love that game. I play it on a yearly basis. I listen to its soundtrack when I work constantly. It has just been a presence in my life ever since it came out. And it is as fresh and as cool today as the day it came out. It's just like a timeless, effortless kind of cool. It's like putting on one of my favorite albums, right? It's a vibe, just an impeccable video game vibe of PlayStation 1, pixely Japanese acid jazz racing. I love it to bits.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. In my head, I think the intro CGI or full motion video, as they used to call it at that time, it's sort of got this beautiful blue skies and really sunny look. And again, that's all comes through in the sort of summer evening racing colors that are used as well. And it's just associated now with like a lovely summer of playing the game. I don't know if it was actually like that when it came out, but that's certainly like the space it occupies it in my memory.
Yeah, it feels really good. It's just like a warm memory that I just like going back to all the time. Now it's come kind of full circle, whereas if you made a game that looked exactly like that today, the indie scene would be fawning all over the cool PlayStation style retro graphics. But like the everything from the UI, the presentation, the logo design, the team libraries, the soundtrack, like everything about it is just so impeccable and so cool. I don't know why only on that one game they fired off on all cylinders like that. It's like, I don't even particularly care about Ridge Racer as a franchise in general. You know, one was cool. And then I get confused about what comes after that, Rave or Rage, or for whatever reason on 4, everything just clicked and they just made one of the coolest games ever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like the other games in that series are doing anything that different, but there's just something about 4 where, like you say, everything comes together. It's all the different aesthetic elements just make it so memorable, even though it doesn't play that different to the other games in the series, I suppose.
It doesn't have anything like mechanically unique about it. This is Ridge Racer before they even started doing like the boost, the nitro mechanic. It doesn't have anything. Like it's just you accelerate and you brake and you drift. That's it. And there's cool music playing and then the maps look cool and the menus look cool and everything looks cool. And it makes you feel cool.
The cars are almost like something out of a dream.
Yeah, there's stand-ins for different types of cars that you can kind of identify even like to a complete neophyte like me. I'm like, oh yeah, that's kind of like a muscle car, that's kind of like a sedan. I don't know what types of cars are, but they got to have a lot more fun with it, where the later cars you would unlock were like all these wild experimental prototypes. Like there was a big hover tank thing, just a big rectangular hover thing that went super fast. It was like the weird rocket car. And there was the Pac-Man car that played the special Pac-Man remix. Like they had fun with it in a way that maybe you don't get to have when you work exclusively with the licensed vehicles.
Okay. And at some point you make the decision to switch from film and animation to the video game industry. Is that something that had always been an ambition for you?
Oh yeah, animation was never like my goal. I had no idea of like I'm gonna make my own cartoon, and it was a cool summer job basically that was better than what I could have gotten elsewhere. Like if I was working in fast food or something, that was just way more interesting than that, because I got to learn all the ins and outs of animation production, you know, from storyboarding to the sound effects to voice recording. Everything was done in house. It was like a vertically integrated production company. And even though like that wasn't my ultimate goal, like I'm a fan of animation. I like cartoons. I like that stuff. So it was interesting to learn how that stuff worked, and maybe a little bit of that applied to video games in some kind of way, but not really. But the whole time it was clear that like eventually I wanted to get into game to make my own games. That was always clear.
You leave and you take a job at Ubisoft in the city. How did that come about? How did you get to, you know, switch to the role of a level designer when you've been, you know, working in animation since school?
Well, there were some years in between that, because the animation stuff, like I mentioned, I was pretty young. I think I was like 16 when I first started my first season there. I did it for a couple of years. And then after that, I ended up, when I dropped out of art school, I ended up going to this kind of like vocational program that was a spinoff of a university in town. It was a video game school, basically, a video game program that lasted 1 year. It was super intensive, and it didn't just teach you the tools and the skills, but it also it taught you like the pipeline of a game production. It kind of simulated a team with different roles and different milestones to hit, basically to prepare you as much as possible to immediately transition into a job when you were out of that school. So whenever a class was graduating, all the studios in town, all the Ubisofts and EAs at the time would come and try and have their first pick of the graduation class and look at everybody's portfolios. Like 90% of the people would get offered a job like almost on the spot. And then like the next month they were working on something or other at Ubisoft. And that's what happened to me. I did that program, and then I immediately got hired at Ubisoft as a level designer, which was my goal at the time. I figured that was the path you had to take. You started out as a lowly level designer. Eventually you made it to lead level designer, and then eventually maybe they let you be a game designer. And then maybe if I played all my cards right, within a decade, I would get to be creative director, and I would get to just pitch a game that I wanted to make to Ubisoft. And Ubisoft would be like, yes, here's millions of dollars and 1,000 people, go and create your vision, which is obviously not at all how it works. And when I realized that, I changed my tune a little bit and realized that maybe the kind of factory approach to making games that Ubisoft was using back then, and I assume it still is, their games have only gotten bigger, was not the right space for me. You know, I just had to kind of adjust the scope of what I was hoping to make to be something that was a little bit more realistic on, you know, with a small team and with the resources that we had. That being said, I still wish I had 1,000 people under me and like $30 million to just go crazy, you know, make the biggest open world nonsense thing. That will never happen, because I'm basically unemployable outside of my own company, and I just don't have the people skills. But there are still things that I would like to make that are completely impossible for me to make outside of that system. And I would have to basically go back and work with all these, a different set of limitations. But yeah, I think I'm much happier just doing my own thing at my own pace.
Tell me about your second game, which came out in 2001. So I guess you're still sort of in your late teens. Can you tell us about the game and what was going on in your life at that time?
The game is Rez. We'll be right back. one of my all-time favorites, kind of two of a piece with the last game, because this one, like Rejoice of Type 4, is just one of my favorite albums that I like to put on all the time, you know, on a yearly, if not more than that, basis. Just do a quick playthrough of all five levels and be satisfied for a while. I just keep going back to it. This one, I don't even really listen to the soundtrack outside of the game because it's so integral. Like, that's the experience. That's what you're doing, is you're experiencing the soundtrack in this visceral, involved kind of way that just doesn't work as simple piece of music for me. You know, I want to feel the vibration of the controller. I want to add my little, you know, click track by repeatedly pressing the attack button, even when there's nothing to target. It just makes a little click sound and you can add to it like that. Rez is forever, man. Rez is never not going to be cool. Rez just keeps coming back and like being re-edited for all these new platforms, for VR, etc. And like new generations keep discovering it, and it's still as cool as the day it came out. Nothing else since then has been this cool. When it came out, I was what? I was still a teenager. I was like 17, maybe. And I imagine that like this is what it's like to go out clubbing with Tetsuya Mizuguchi. Like, it's exactly like this. Like, I'm sure he's captured it. Like, it's just such an experience. And the people that made it seem so involved in that culture over there.
Yeah, it is. It's such a timeless game. I still don't really understand how it has such a timeless quality. I mean, I think maybe a lot of those Dreamcast era games, because they weren't necessarily chasing realism, did have like, you know, a different kind of longevity. If you look at, say, like Jet Set Radio or something like that, that is another game that hasn't dated in the same way. But this goes deeper than just the visuals, right? It's the whole concept is, as you say, timeless. I don't know that if that's because you're playing as like a, you know, a computer character floating through space, so there's nothing to tie it to a particular era, but yeah, I don't know.
It's Tron, do you think? Graphics. It's wireframe. It's just the most basic early computational graphics imaginable, but set to a cool techno soundtrack wrapped in this whole concept of, you know, what they like to call synesthesia. Which is not what synesthesia is, but you know, they were going for a kind of multimedia, multi-sensory, everything affecting everything. The vibration affects the music affects the graphics affect the vibration, and it works. It just worked. Like, they nailed it. You don't get that out of a mechanically almost identical game like Panzer Dragoon, which is also great, also has an amazing soundtrack, awesome art and everything. But it doesn't like tickle your brain the way that Rez does. I don't know if it's like ASMR or what, but there's something to it that makes my brain happy. And it's like, I can't help but when I play the, like, I'm on the edge of my chair and I'm tapping my foot. It's like I'm nodding my head. Like, I'm all practically dancing sitting down, like as much as you can dance sitting down. And it, like, I don't know, it just, the effect works every time for me. I just don't get sick of it. I get back to it in 2D and VR. It's all good.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it benefits as well from a soundtrack that has not aged either. Like, I'm thinking, so Rez came out 22 years ago, whatever. And I don't know, those artists that were composing for the soundtrack, the music they were making then, you can still hear sort of in today's music, but music that was made 20 years before Rez came out, like in 1980, just sounded so different, right? And so that's also helped sort of preserve that agelessness. Perhaps it's never really gone out of fashion in the same way.
Yeah, that maybe says more about electronic music in the last 20 years than it does about Rez. But I mean, I say that, but like, I'm super into all that stuff. I never got out of that kind of music. Like, it doesn't, it's like, it's oldies now, right? Like, it's oldies, but goodies. I like my old style, my old time techno music.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found.
LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And then, so tell me, you after you work at Ubisoft, you have a short stint of working on movie tie-in games. Is that right? Which is, I guess, you know, for younger listeners, maybe those things don't exist anymore, right? But there was a time when every big movie had a big video game.
Pretty much every movie, every kids TV show. That was one of the specialties of my next employer after Ubisoft. I ended up at, they went by A2M back then, Artificial Mind and Movement. That's it. That stood for Artificial Mind and Movement. They later rebranded to their current name of Behavior, the British spelling. Yeah, that company at the time was pretty much a Game Boy Advance / DS Disney Channel TV show tie-in factory. And it was somehow even worse than Ubisoft. It was like out of the frying pan into an even worse frying pan.
What made you join there?
I still wanted to work in video games. I needed a job. I had a couple of friends that had moved there. You know, that happens all the time. You know, an industry as small as the video game industry in Montreal, people go from studio to studio. And I thought that maybe working at a smaller studio on smaller projects would let me have a little bit more of influence over them and maybe be able to steer them in more interesting directions, especially in the GBA and DS scene that was just starting around the time. Like, you know, there were so many cool, weird, experimental things happening and people figuring out what you could do with two screens, stylus, touch screen, microphone, etc.
And did that work out? Were you able to do that?
No, not at all. I mean, to some degree, in, you know, some parts of some games, we got to have a little bit of fun just trying to emulate things like Phantom Hourglass when that came out, or like, oh, wow, they do everything with the stylus. Maybe we can make our game work like that also, and trying to reverse engineer what Nintendo was doing at the time. A good learning experience, definitely, on that level. But I was looking at things like the Bit Generation series coming out of Japan. I don't know if you remember those for the Game Boy Advance.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Just these like super stylish, like boutique mini games made by a bunch of cool Japanese indie weirdos and their friends, packaged just sublimely. Just the best packaging, that series, the logo, the boxes, so cool and desirable. And it was on GBA, and they were made for cheap because it's easy to make GBA games. And we had this whole studio there. People were experts at pumping out GBA games. It was like, what if we just make a little skunk team, a little wet works on the side, like just a handful of people in between projects. And you let us, i.e. me, come up with whatever like weird, cool experimental thing we want. And like, we'll create you a little sub label and it'll be exactly like Bit Generations. And they were not into that because that doesn't make money as much as the That's So Raven GBA game or, you know, something like that. So I found myself kind of in the same position again, just constantly making the same arguments over and over again. Like, we could be making cool stuff. Like, we could if we really wanted to. We got all the resources, we got all the talent, we got, you know, tons of people that have been here for way longer than I have.
It's that thing as well, when you're that sort of age and you are a bit fearless, aren't you? And you, But you can come into a company and just really be like, okay, we need to do things like this now.
Yeah, it's incredible, like the how much of that I did and how little I realized it was completely unearned and like not my place at all to be doing it. Like I think about it today, I'm you know, mortified. But back then, it's like, you know, I'm fresh out of school, I'm hot shit. I'm gonna tell you what's cool and hot right now. We're gonna do these cool, weird little experimental Japanese games instead of this Disney Channel crap. It's amazing that they didn't fire me.
Well, I can see, I think my take on that is that when you're being like that subconsciously, you probably know that you're in the wrong place for the vision that you have and the things you want to do, but you know, your life circumstances mean you need a job and blah, blah, blah. And you're sort of in the right place because you're working at a company that makes video games.
Yeah, you're so close.
Yeah, but basically you're completely in the wrong place, aren't you? And so all of that sort of pushing against the management or whatever is just really your own frustration at like, this is like, I know where I want to get to, but I don't seem to be there or on the right path or something. How do you then get on the right paths and start working on the actual game that you want to?
Around that time is when I first started dabbling into the nascent indie scene back then, which was pretty much to me the TixSource forums. That was it. Like that was the place. That's where everybody met up. That's where everybody knew everybody else from. And you know, I'm still friends with some of these people to this day. That was the like come to Jesus moment of like, oh, I found the way. I found my people. Finally, I belong somewhere. These people think like me. They want to do the same sort of things I want to do. And they're succeeding. I was at GDC that year. I think it was 2008. I met all those people. Like I met Derek Yu, all those TixSource guys. And I saw them demoing their game at the IGF Pavilion. These games made by one or two people working out of their basement without a side job. And just to learn that was possible, that it was clearly difficult, like a lot of sacrifice, but look at them, they're doing it. They're about my age. You know, some of them live in Canada also and have similar realities to deal with, and they're managing somehow. And that's when I got it into my head that was going to be the path. And my attention, my focus, and all my efforts kind of shifted to that while I was still working my day job. But it was clear that as soon as I could, I was going to quit and dedicate myself fully to what eventually became Fez.
What was it that financially it made that possible? Because, you know, obviously you need to live, don't you, if you're going to work on a project like that?
We were one of the first, if not the first, recipient of what would eventually become the Indie Fund. Remember that? They probably still exist. I'm not sure. But before they were the Indie Fund, they were the Fez Fund. They were funding just one game, and it was us. And out of the success of that, like working out pretty well, and they're like, yeah, this is cool. We can do more of this. They kind of organized themselves slightly differently and rebranded and became the Indie Fund and went on to fund a bunch of different video games. But we received some money. I don't remember how much. Not, you know, a ton. Some tens of thousands of dollars. And we were just a couple of kids that didn't need a whole lot of money to live. That's the secret ingredient, is having a really frugal lifestyle at the time. Today, if I were to get like the exact same set of people under the same conditions to make another game, it would be way more expensive because we have kids and mortgages and, you know, we're nearing 40 now. And we life gets more expensive. When you're early 20s, you know, you just eat ramen all the time. You live in a tiny, shitty apartment that you share with like six other people, and you can give it your all. You've got nothing to lose, you know? You can work all night. You can sacrifice your youth to achieve these things in a way that would be completely impossible now. At a certain point, you're cognizant of that and you capitalize on it. It's like, this is my advantage right now, is I can do that. And I realized that it's like a limited window, that I'm not always going to be in a situation where I can just say fuck it and be poor for a while. And, you know, we were very lucky to actually get some financial support pretty early on that we managed to just kind of stretch out and get a little bit more here and there. And then a publisher got involved, and that took us to the end, but we were, you know, it was pretty much like paycheck to paycheck the whole time because nobody was planning on it taking that many years. You know, if I pitched it that way when I first met Renaud, it was like, hey, want to spend the next 5 years of your life on like practically no money and the low chance of success? It's a crazy gamble. One that I wouldn't repeat today. You know, I've got more to lose now, and I know more. And I'm more afraid. That's the consequence of knowing more.
Yeah, that's right. That's so true. Okay, so do you want to tell us about your third game, which is from 2012?
Changing register a little bit. We're getting out of the chill out vibes, games as albums, and getting into exotic murder tourism, which is another area of video gaming that I like a lot. Dishonored. Dishonored 1, to me, is the gold standard of narrative design and world building in video games. No one does it better than Arkane, and Arkane hasn't done it better than in the world of Dishonored. It's just one of those games that every now and then I just want to get back into. I just want to, like, you know, wrap myself in it. Every little detail of that universe, every little book and letter you find, the texture, the grain of that world, the way it lets you like crawl around on all four through people's garbage and just find all kinds of things you're not supposed to find. They're the best. I aspire to one day make that kind of immersive simulator game that has just that rich of a world to lose yourself into. The fiction, the environmental storytelling, the architecture, the technology, every little part of the world is custom made, like is bespoke to tell a part of a bigger story. Like nothing is just thrown in there without care, or basic things like chairs and tables are reimagined to be special chairs and tables from that universe that you could recognize like in a lineup and be like, oh yeah, that's a Dunwall style table because they build them weird that way because of whale oil or something. Like everything is just so unique and interesting, even though you can tell like, oh, this one is supposed to be, you know, alternate history Britain. You can tell what the inspiration is, but still everything tells the story that this is an alternate universe that where technology is developed in different ways and had an impact on architecture and the city design. And it's just so rich. I love in a video game when you're somewhere you're not supposed to be. Even like if that's the whole point of the game, like that feeling of like, I'm in a restricted area, nobody wants me here, nobody can know I'm here, that is just always exhilarating to me. And then, you know, the kind of the political aspect of it, of just all these shitty rich people that need to get got, and you're the only one that can do it with your magical assassin powers.
What kind of player are you, by the way? I mean, it sounds like you're into the stealth element.
Yeah, I try to play it like as perfectly as possible. I try to get the what they call it, the ghost rating, I think. I don't want to trigger any alarms. I don't want anybody to know I was there. I'm not against killing a lot of people. Sometimes I'll do the like I only kill the target run, but yeah, I really like sneaking around. I like finding all the alternate entries into buildings, all the windows that are open on the third floor or basement windows you can get into, and you know, crawling around on ledges on outside of buildings, and just like you really get to appreciate all the detail that goes into the level design and the architecture. Like everything is just so considered because they're not big open world games. You know, they get to focus and have this greater intent in the design.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And so many really good games just have quite a small geography, don't they? But they then use all of that manpower that goes into making it really deep and really textured, but they're not trying to like do this expansive world that you can run around. I mean those games are great,
yeah,
obviously,
yeah.
But it's wonderful when a development team says, actually, we're going to throw loads of money at just a very small area and make it incredibly textured and rich.
Arkane are masters at doing that without having it feel like it's small and constrained. Even if like at some point you've played so much of a level, and I tend to like just replay a level over and over and over until I know all the ins and outs of it. And then you have like this detailed 3D map of it in your head, and you know that it's like, it's not a real city. It's just like, it's Imagineering, right? Like they're cutting off the streets in strategic ways that makes it seem like it looks like it's a full city and you can see into the distance, but the area you're allowed to explore is much more deliberate on that, but it never feels that way.
And Dishonored comes out in 2012, which is the same year that your game Fez comes out. Were you able to enjoy Dishonored at that time? Was it sort of something that you were able to disappear into after all those years of toil on your own project?
Oh yeah, I did a lot of that. Once my job on Fez was done, there was still a lot of stuff to be done, but a lot of it was on the more technical side of things. So that fell on the, yes. So I was more disengaged. Like once we shipped for gold, I was just like washing my hands of it. And like, okay, there's no more art. There's no more design to be done. Actually, the first thing I did pretty much exactly the week I was done is when Skyrim came out. And that I disappeared into that for like 6 months straight. And then later in the year, Dishonored came out and I dove into that.
I remember seeing you, it must have been about 3 or 4 weeks before Fez came out. You'd come over for Nottingham Game City, now defunct games event that was wonderful. I remember interviewing you at that time, and I went back and actually read the sort of back and forth we had there. And you put, I've been in burnout for years now. Like, I'm always a bit sick. I'm always a bit depressed. I've lost interest in everything. I'm always tired. I feel like I'm going to have to rebuild my life because everything has gone to shit. I've had to neglect every aspect of my life to get this game done. Do you recognize yourself in that?
Oh, I remember that. I remember that clearly. Yeah. Poor young Phil. I did have to rebuild a lot of things, and I did have to take a lot of time off to kind of recalibrate and re-energize and just change my approach to a lot of things. You know, I, as you mentioned in the intro, I dropped off of social media some years ago. That was a big change, you know, in my life in general, and just how I approached my job, how I approached my audience, going from approaching it to not approaching it at all. That was an adjustment. I think it was ultimately for the best.
My sense is that some of this stuff like had its origins in the film that you took part in, Indie Game the Movie. Which you know, maybe some people haven't heard of, but at the time it was kind of a big deal because it was, here is this film that's, you know, telling the story of the video game industry. It was shown at Sundance and things like that. And I think you were probably, I think it's fair to say, the star of that film, in the sense that, you know, you were just very passionate and outspoken, and that always comes across well. That's always memorable, right, on film. And I wonder if you know, how do you feel about that experience of participating in that now? Is it something you regret, or do you feel cool with it?
I don't regret it, definitely. I don't think I'd be able to watch it now today. It's been some years. It's been a long time since I've seen it. That being said, I'm glad it exists as a document, right? One day I'm going to be really thrilled that it's there when I'm even more further removed from it. Now it's painful because it was a very painful time. Like I said, I remember all of it. Like it's still pretty fresh, even though it's more than a decade since then. At the time, it just kind of heightened everything. We felt everything more because the cameras were there, and then people were watching it and reacting to it. And, you know, there were a lot of opinions about it. It was just like, it was a big deal. Like, it was a big thing leading up to it, its release, and then the kind of DLC that they did for it. Like, basically, like a whole other movie's worth of stuff was put out as extras. And you know, it's of its time. It's definitely that very specific corner of indie games at that very specific time. And that's kind of the the biggest issue that I have with it today is looking back, like how it's all just North American white guys making puzzle platformers. Like, it's so specific. It's such a narrow view of what that field was even back then. I've told James and Dizan this a bunch of times that I think they should make another one that doesn't do that, that specifically talks to like a broader spectrum of people making different kinds of games in different countries, different backgrounds. The way that it showed, like that it basically presented indie games as a whole. It represented indie games as a whole, even if it presented only a small fraction of it. People were like, oh, that's indie games. That I saw it in a movie. It's that kind of guy making that kind of game and having very similar experiences of getting picked up by these big platforms that were doing a big indie game thing at the time. You know, you mentioned that I was like, we were the first wave of indie games. And I always felt like of that wave, we were the last ones on that boat. But that those opportunities that we had back then don't really exist anymore, don't work the same way. Like, there's no such thing as the Summer of Arcade being like the biggest deal of the year. Like, if you can make it to Summer of Arcade, like, you're set for life. Like, that's it. Like, your game's a hit.
And let me just say, that's such a shame that Summer of Arcade is not around. This is when Xbox would run, you know, one big indie game a week throughout the summer. And they were always sort of, you know, they were fantastic games, weren't they? And like you say, it could really make a project.
Especially a couple of years in, it came with like a certain cachet. Like, people like, oh, what are the four or five games that they picked to be in the Summer of Arcade? And those games had their profile raised just by virtue of being part of the Summer of Arcade. That was very desirable. Like, you wanted that. It was just a completely different landscape. So that's why now the movie is interesting as a time capsule of like, this is how it used to be. This is how it used to work. And you can't do that anymore. Don't try to do it like in the game, the movie.
After a few years later, people started to criticize the movie a bit, I suppose, for glorifying the image of the artist as a suffering for their art, right? The idea that you had to damage yourself in order to create something wonderful, which isn't like not a new story, that's been around for decades. But, you know, I'm just struck as well because during, at one point, I think, in that film, you say that if Fez doesn't come out, then you're going to kill yourself or something like that. I don't know how serious you were being or not. But I mean, that sense of, you know, really having to give your everything to something you're creating, has your perspective shifted on that now?
Oh yeah, dramatically. I would never go that hard ever again. I don't think I'm capable of it. Like the burnout I suffered coming out of it was real and took a long time to not get over, because in my experience, you never really fully recover. You're always diminished, you know. But that's also part of getting older. I just can't put in the same number of hours that I use. Like, physically, I can't. Like, my arms hurt too much. I have got repetitive stress injuries now all up and down my body because of how hard I worked back then, you know, pulling all-nighters, working 7 days a week. But at the time, it's all-encompassing. It's your whole world. Everything depends on it. Like, you're not just your livelihood, but your reputation. Because in the case of Fez, you know, we started talking about it as soon as we thought of it. And then we had to manage like 5 years of hype. So there was like 5 years of expectation of people asking when it was coming out and is it going to be good? And you just had to deliver because your reputation was on the line. There is, for me, this feeling that like, I can't do this again. I can't, like, if it fails, I can't just turn around and spend another 5 years on another epic, ridiculous thing. Cause my body won't let me anymore. I had one shot at doing that and I spent it on Fez and I got very, very lucky that it worked out. Some people worked as hard, if not harder, on their thing, and then didn't work out.
Let's take a break and turn to your fourth game for your console, which is from 2016, and another game of assassination. Can you tell us about it?
Hitman: World of Assassination.
Thank you.
So, Hitman World of Assassination, talking about Hitman 123. What a masterpiece that thing is. What an incredible achievement. God, it's so good. Where to begin?
So you play as Agent 47, and you just, it's a bit like James Bond, but with, if James Bond was restricted to just doing everything, like silent kills, basically.
Yeah, if James Bond was tasked with assassinating everybody with a toilet. Or like even dumber things than that. That's another thing, like Ridge Racer Type 4, like I'm not a James Bond guy at all. That doesn't play for me for whatever reason. But in the context of this video game, all these tropes, these aesthetics, the gadget, the supervillains, everything, like the, you know, the hidden underground bases, the villain lairs, etc. Like Dishonored, I like this game because it gives you just this beautiful, intricate puzzle box of a level, like crafted to such a degree, so many options, so many paths, so many little side things to discover, ridiculous sequence of events you can trigger, and the way that it really is like a clockwork thing, like things that happen at a certain time, there are opportunities you can miss. And the way I played that game, well, when the first one came out, it was episodic, right? It was only the Paris map, and it took them like a couple of months to put out the second map, which was Sapienza, one in Italy. So for like 2 months, all I had was that one Paris map. So I played it nonstop for 2 months. Like I got mastery level 20. I had just about every one of those, like the really long list of like, here's all the different ways you can kill that guy. I got almost all of them. I just knew the ins and outs of that entire place, like the back of my hand, and not just on a spatial level, but on a temporal level also. Like I knew when things were going to happen. I knew when this character was going to be in that room. Even if I'm on the complete other end of the map, I know, oh, the lady I have to assassinate is having like her phone meeting in her room right now. And I can use that to my advantage somehow. Like I know them like they're real places that I've lived or worked at. Like the layout of Paris is burnt into my mind forever. You can play it all kinds of different ways, but I like to play it like Dishonored, like silent assassin, in and out. Nobody knows I was there. And there is never like a big action moment in a playthrough like that. The playthrough can take 1 hour, and it's 1 hour of just me slowly walking, you know, casual, like to not attract attention. Like I don't run places if I don't have to, because I want it to look like I'm just the smoothest, coolest assassin in the world. Even though it's everything is measured and calm, and there is no big shootout, there's no big explosion, and then you just kind of like walk out the front gate. Like my heart is racing. Like every time when that music swells at the end, when they know you're approaching the exit, it's, to me, it's, there's something like sophisticated about it. Not just like it presents itself in a very sophisticated way. Right? It's all these like 5-star hotels and the world of the super rich and their ridiculous mansions, and it's very opulent, like just on talking about the number of assets in that game. But then the richness of the things you can do, like once you really know the ins and outs of that game, once you know the rules and like how people are going to react. One thing I love doing in these games is when I know that there's like a long routine, let's say there's an NPC you have to kill, that they do like a whole walk around the whole museum or whatever, and it takes them 5-10 minutes to do the whole round. Even if I've just missed them, I'll go behind the bar as the bartender and just wait for 5 to 10 minutes real time and do nothing. Like I just watch the people walk by, and I go into whatever they call it, like spy vision, and see that little red highlight of the guy at the end of the map. I'm like, okay, now he's going to the bathroom. Now he's going to his office. And that's exciting for me. Like, you know, it's not a fun game to watch me play, because they're like, please do something. It's like, no, wait, it's just 5 more minutes.
Yeah, you're just enjoying your job.
And then he's going to have to go puke in the bathroom, and that's when I strike. You're drowning in the toilet. And then, you know, you can do stupid things like that and still pull off the perfect, nobody saw you, nobody knew you were there.
That is a level of patience that I do not possess.
Yeah, it's not fun for my wife or my friends watching me play that game, but that's how I like to play this game. Like almost like in real time, if it was an actual simulator that I was partaking in. So I have like maybe 5 maps left for rainy days. Every now and then, just like, you know what, I'm gonna have myself a little Hitman weekend. It's like a little getaway. I'm gonna go to some resort island, wear a Hawaiian shirt, and just eat the rich for a couple of hours.
I just want to like quickly return to, we talked a little bit about Afterfest comes out, and you know, people love the game, quite rightly. It's hugely celebrated, and then there's a fair amount of pressure, I suppose, on you to work on a sequel. And, you know, you, during this period, like, as you talked about earlier, you know, you have, I guess, a difficult relationship with social media, and you're getting attacked from all sides, I suppose. And you have, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but some kind of spat with a American video games journalist or something, which, as I understand the story, is sort of maybe the catalyst for you saying, actually, I'm out, I'm going to leave social media. And also, there's not going to be a Fez 2 now. Is that correct? And I guess my other question is, it seems like that's a fairly minor reason to cancel a creative project like that. So do you think in some way you were maybe just looking for an out?
One thing didn't cause the other quite that directly. You know, the thing that happened was the last straw, where I was already thinking about doing all those things, and there was just like this one moment where, yeah, you know what, fuck it, like I'm not doing that. So obviously I wasn't feeling it to begin with. It felt like the thing to do, you know, strike while the iron's hot, then just make a sequel. That's what you do in video games, you make a franchise. And the more I started working on that seriously, the less I was feeling it. And the more I was getting, once again, disillusioned with everything, even in my position of having just had a successful video game, having to follow up on that was a lot of pressure. Maybe it was a bit of an out. Like, it certainly wasn't planned that, like, we're going to wait for one journalist to say something stupid and then just, like, blow up and cancel it. But, you know, we weren't that advanced. We didn't have a whole lot to show other than the logo we showed. I certainly had concepts and concept art and things like that, but we didn't have anything playable. We were in, you know, pre-conceptual phase for the game when we announced it. Deciding to walk away was pretty easy because, you know, there was no real investment at that point. It hadn't really cost us anything in time or money or energy, and there was nothing really to be super attached to. The way that, like, at some point, what's the term when you've got, like, you've invested so much in something that you can't...
Sunk cost.
But yeah, sunk cost. You definitely get to a point like that eventually where, as much as I fantasize sometimes to just cancel Fez 1 towards the end, like maybe year 4 or 4.5, like, I was like, oh God, what if we just canceled it? What if we just fucking disappeared and no one ever sees or hears from us ever again? That became just like a fantasy, you know, like an escape, but it was obviously not a realistic thing to actually do. But with Fez 2, at some point, it was like, you know what? Let's just not do it. Let's call it off. And that was very liberating to break away from that and then realize that I can do something else. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be a video game. I don't want to say what, because I'm still working on it, but let's go in a completely different direction. And just to step away from the social media, which, you know, around the time was starting to get real toxic. It's obviously way worse now.
Right. You were like the canary in the Twitter cage.
At some point, it becomes like such a big part of your job. And even if you're not working or like tweeting about your project, but you're still expected to have a presence, right? You're still expected to put out content, to do something, to just remind people that you're still there and have like all dumb jokes every day. Or it's like, it's a lot. You just welcome all this sewage into your life also when you do it. Like there's no opt out for the sewage pipe that gets opened up into your living room when you're a public persona on the internet. And just making that cut, that severance of just like, you know what, I'm just going to go back to just being private me. I don't have to tweet every dumb thing that goes through my brain all the time. It was like kicking any other addiction at first. But after the worst of it is over, you see in hindsight, like, oh, wow, that thing was driving me crazy. That thing was poison.
Yeah.
And even though sometimes you miss certain aspects of it, because it can be very validating, very gratifying. And then to decide to go back to work in a completely quiet, secretive way, it can be hard, but can be freeing also. Like, you don't know the things that I didn't finish, that I ended up canceling, these projects that I worked on, and there's no like big drama around it, right? There's no, it doesn't follow me around forever.
Yeah, you've only got the weight of your own expectations to deal with, not those of everyone else.
Yeah, which can be a lot. That's enough for me. Just me is good. But at the same time, you know, that's just part of the game now. You have to let people know your stuff is out at some point. You can't just put out a game into the void and expect that on the reputation of your last game alone, somehow it's gonna carry and it's gonna travel and people are gonna hear about it. And you have to become front facing at some point. But I've decided to be more strategic about when I do that and when I don't do it, rather than just accept the fact that you're just supposed to be front facing all the time, forever, and deal with all the negative elements forever.
Yeah. Yeah. I sort of feel jealous of, I don't know, people like David Bowie or someone like that, who was, you know.
What, the dead?
No.
You envy the dead? Is that what you're trying to?
Oh, but just people who were creating stuff at a time when I can't imagine him being on Twitter going, hey, I've got a new single out or something like that. I mean, maybe he would have been, but yeah, I suppose that was a temporal privilege he got of working at the time he did. That now there's just so much of everything, so many books, so much music, so many films, so many video games, that just to get noticed, you feel like, unless you're like that very 0.1% of people who are that well known, that you have to be shouting about it, don't you? But let's turn to your fifth and final game. Can you tell me about it?
My fifth and final game is The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. I was currently in my, I don't know, fifth or sixth inning into Breath of the Wild, a game I've been stretching out for, I did the math, it was the 5.8 years since it released. I finally beat it last week. It's a game that I loved so much that like I didn't want it to end. I just couldn't bring myself to actually wrapping it up. I just wanted to keep it going. And in my family, playing Zelda at Christmas is a bit of a tradition. Most years, someone is playing one Zelda or another. I don't know why, it's just always been the case. So over the holidays, to get myself in the mood, I just started playing Breath of the Wild again. And this time, because we're just months away from Tears of the Kingdom, knowing that there's more coming, I was like, okay, I can finish it. And also, I should finish it before I start the other one. But it's a game I've been coming back to the last almost 6 years. And you know, some games, sometimes you spend just a few months away and you come back, it's like you forgot everything about them. You don't, like, it's, you don't know how to ride a bicycle anymore. You have to learn everything from scratch. With Breath of the Wild, it's like just slipping into a warm bath Like, it's just so comfortable to get back to, even though, like, it's a fairly complex game. Like, there's a lot of buttons that do a lot of things and a lot of little maneuvers and switching weapons on the fly and things like shield surfing that require like a whole sequence of buttons. It can be quite a bit to get back into, but everything else about the game and the world and how it feels, it's just so welcoming. Another one of my favorite game worlds. I have a whole thing. I like games that have space and time. That's my big recipe for like a good open world or open-ish, you know, like the Dishonored end of the spectrum. Games that try to present you with a world that you're in. When they have the space aspect, you know, architecture, level design, whatever you want to call it, but also the passage of time is an obvious and important part of it. The feeling of events unfolding over time, of the way the story unfolds into that world, the way that different characters are at different places at different points in a day or different points in the story, and people are moving from village to village. It feels like a whole simulated world. I love that. That's the magical recipe for me to get completely lost in a game for hundreds of hours, is games that capture those two elements of, which are like, you can kind of break down all of reality to these two key ingredients, like space and time. That sums up just about everything. But games that lean into it and do interesting things with it, that's when it becomes magical. Like, I'm almost 6 years into it. I'm still having moments where I discover a brand new thing that I didn't know was possible in that world, or that I'd never seen, or a corner of the map I'd never seen, or a mechanic, or a relation between elements. The way the world is designed in that game is just a masterclass of open world design. I just think it's so good. It's one of those games that makes me fall in love with games every time I play it, and like kind of reaffirms to myself that, like, yeah, this is what I want to be making. Like, this is a worthwhile use of my time on this world, trying to make a thing that makes other people feel the way this makes me feel right now. Like, the level of comfort and wonder, joy and mystery. It you know, makes you feel like you're a kid again.
Hey, Phil, thank you so much for sharing with us your choices. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Do you have a name for this games machine?
Yeah. What about the PlayStation 6?
Well, Fez 2.
Yeah, call it Fez 2. The console does not come with Fez 2. It's like those special edition that don't come with the game.
Yeah, it'll arrive at some point.
Yeah, maybe. It's a mail-in thing. Yes, call it the Fez 2.
Okay, nice.
People will love that.
They will. You won't get any problems from that, I'm sure.
No.
Yeah, thank you again, Phil.
You're welcome.
It's been great to talk to you. I hadn't spoken to Phil for quite a few years before this conversation for this episode today, so I wasn't quite sure where he'd be at, what his mental state would be. Like many people, the last time that I really saw Phil, at least in the public eye, was when he was right in the eye of that social media storm and the news cycle around Fez 2, and it was clear that everything he was going through at that time was having an adverse effect on his life. So I completely understand why he would have stepped away from social media, why he would not want to be a public figure anymore. And having heard him talk there about where he was at with the second game, the follow-up to Fez, I understand why as well he would have cancelled that game. Although I have to say, there's a small part of me that hopes one day he will maybe return to that project. Anyway, how wonderful to hear from Phil again, to hear his passion coming through, his great knowledge about games, his great taste, I have to say as well. I mean, really fantastic choices for this console. These are very, very fine video games that he has chosen, enduring as well. So yeah, thank you for listening. Thank you to Phil as well for coming on and for talking to me and for being so open about his life and everything he's been through, and his growth as well, if that's the right word, how he's moved on at least. You can write to me at myperfectconsole@gmail.com. Thank you to those of you who have done so already. Please just continue. It's lovely to hear your thoughts and also your suggestions for potential future guests. If you do have a spare moment, I would really appreciate if you could leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you get your podcasts. It does help other people to find the show. You can find me on Twitter at Simon Parkin. And you can also follow the podcast for weekly updates and little previews of who's coming up next week at My Perfect Console, with the O's removed from console. That's because the My Perfect Console is too long for Twitter, so I had to do something. Oh, and Perfect Console is already taken. Lastly, if you would like to support the podcast financially, then just head to Acast Plus. You can become an early access supporter. You will get your episodes 24 hours before the public and also without any ads as well, if that appeals. It's also a great way just to support what I'm doing here financially. Okay, next week we will be back with one new guest, their five games, and one more perfect console.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.